Welcome to my Bob Thurman podcast. I'm so grateful some good friends enabled me to present them to you. If you enjoy them and find them useful, please think of becoming a member of Tibet House US to help preserve Tibetan culture. Tibet House is the Dalai Lama's cultural center in America. All best wishes. Have a great day.
This is episode 33, titled Visualizing an Enlightened Universe.
The Medicine Buddha meditation, or the whole sort of set and setting meditation that Tibetan, Indo-Tibetan Buddhism uses, you know, in relation to whatever meditation one might be focused on. Remember, we went through the 15 different things. Mm-hmm. So your big meditation might be meditating on the preciousness of your embodiment as a human being. Okay. Say, that's the real, that's what one is working on, like,
right.
Because one is aware that, well, I have from my common sense culture that I'm just some sort of genetic product, and that I don't really have a soul, and that when I die I'll be nothing, and there's a random mutation, and right. It's just an accident in the universe, blah, blah, blah. I've already conveyed that, what is our consensual reality sense in our culture, in materialist culture. And then, you know, the opposite of that is the Indian one, and the spiritual one, where one is has a soul continuum, not just Eastern, also Christians have that, Jews have that. There's going to be some soul continuum, and there's going to be some consequence, therefore, of how you've lived in a future state. And then there's some difference in the different ones about how the past has happened and how we've gotten to this point, right? Former lives or somehow existing inconceivably within God in theistic traditions or whatever it is, right? So say that's what you're working on. But the beautiful insight in the Indo-Tibetan tradition is, and in a way the yogic tradition does it sort of less, and in Zen also less articulately, but the tradition is that the context which you assume will very much determine how much progress you can make. And when you create an artificial context, like an imagined field where there's a Buddha and where the Buddhas are right there in the sky, like a big Tanka painting like that, they're all right there, and then all the other beings are all around, you're sort of making vivid to yourself a kind of preferable image, and then also you cancel a little bit your own self-image about, well, I know I'm like this, and I think I'm doing that, and what am I, and therefore what can I really expect to do, which is not much, the way we normally have an image about ourselves. We're sort of be the same me that went in and went out. You know, we have that kind of, you know, people, that's what Uncle Joe's Thanksgiving or Passover or Christmas wisdom is at the dinner is, nobody ever changes. They're always all the same. You know, people always go around saying that to excuse themselves manifesting their own dumb habits all the time, usually. Like not quitting smoking, not avoiding drinking one extra cocktail, and not appreciating the stuffing that grandma made, and instead having some stupid political argument over the dinner, as people tend to do, don't they? So, by creating such a thing as a part of the meditation, I mean, and people do it without consciously doing it. For example, people go to a meditation center, and in a meditation center, there's like a wall with a time test like that. Or in Zen, they have what they call a Buddha hall, where you don't meditate, you do rituals. And then your meditation hall, there's just a wall in front of you, but there's a Manjushri behind you, Monju Bosatsu. You know, Manjushri is behind you holding a little stick to like urge you on, you know, to concentrate. So you're creating a kind of context within which you kind of get more alert. Do you know what I mean? Because you're in that special context. Just like in a classroom, you get a certain context, or in a gym, you know. So context affects us. So here, you're imaginatively creating an ideal context so that your meditation should have an ideal outcome, which is you understand the thing you're really trying to understand. You have, oh, Eureka, you have an insight. Wow. And you know, the big insight, and always in America, to me and at Menla, the big insight, well, there's two really big insights. But one of the really big insights is this former and future life thing. To break through, and which means really just that you have a mind. You are an individual person as a subtle being, as a mind. And maybe that mind at a subtle level is a soul, which always changes, though. It isn't a fixed thing. It doesn't belong to anybody. It's except you. It is you, but it's always changing. So, and it's always been changing, and you've gotten to hear by changing it in a positive way because you have a positive thing. Look at that nice earring that you're wearing, and necklace, you know, and you went to the nice concert last night, right? So there's lots of things you've contributed. You've been educated. You've done this. You've done nice things for people. People like you, you know, and you're like that. So that means this goes on forever. And whatever little things you do make a difference. And they do matter. And they're not random. And there's no cutoff of the consequences by just shooting yourself and being nothing, you know, or expiring with Jack, calling Jack Kevorkian and expiring when you finally get to the hospital stage of old age and like, let me out of here, you know? And then there'll be no consequence. So it didn't matter if I was nice to Aunt Gertie or not nice to her. It does matter.
So that insight comes?
So that is the big takeaway as far as I'm concerned, as far as America goes. And that's really where the mindfulness craze in America actually is also kind of aiming at that, however people sell it. However they approach it. The mindfulness thing is like, even every little twitch in your consciousness matters. And so you it behooves you to put focus on being aware of whether your reaction is a little more angry and unpleasant or a little less angry and unpleasant. That tiny baby step difference is huge. And then that changes the whole quality of life. You know, Oprah had a great time for a while, and occasionally I think it comes back to it, with Eckhart Tolle, when she read The Power of Now, and then a second book he wrote about heaven and earth or something. Really, but basically his whole shtick is The Power of Now. Like, forget about everything else and just be here now. And then Oprah's like, when I read that, the earth moved. You know, it had a big impact on her. So, because she suddenly realized, you know, like there was a quality of the moment that was important. But, you know, as I said to Eckhart when we had some pasta together, if someone still has this basic idea that they don't really have a soul, then their now is a kind of escapist now. They're like not worrying about the past or future, and they think that by not worrying about it, it doesn't matter how it will be. And they're just sort of dropping out from anxiety about it, which is dropping out from anxiety is always good, but it's not as good as being in the moment where the moment can always be just a tiny bit better, if not for you, for someone, or in some way. And therefore, that becomes a vivid, intense now, where you're like an artist in that now. You're making that now better, somehow. Not anxiously. It might be by relaxing and not worrying to letting it go, surfing the now. But you're conscious that the now, whatever's happening in the now, will have a consequence. And therefore, it should be better and not worse. So it's a responsible
but
now.
But you don't have to worry about that?
What?
But you don't have to worry about that.
Well, you know, you can worry blissfully. Do you know what I mean? Like an esthete, a connoisseur, worries about, has the wine breathed for enough minutes? And did I sniff it? And did I clean my palate with a little lemon sherbet? And so, you know, and makes an art about it. And that's not, we don't consider that a really grinding worry. Of course, they can go overboard. And like, they won't even touch it. They won't even get a sniff. So, you know, everything in, you know, in balance, you know. But why not, you know? Why be afraid of a little thinking? People going, the best thing is not to think. Oh, I'm so happy when I don't think. Well, how about developing a kind of blissfulness and happiness where you can also think a little?
Yeah.
To make it nicer. Yes, what was your hand was going up?
I had a question. I'm not really, it's a little hard to...
You're not really what?
It's a little bit hard to express, but it goes back to the point of not finding. If we're a bunch of processes of biological karma, mind, cosmic...
It goes back to what? To the whole...
To the not...
Kielbasa. That's a real going back. That's good news. But what? Which piece of all of that?
So the piece of two things, of how if we're just a lot of processes and never the same thing, how compassion kind of works within that, and then also not finding the not finding. I'm still not finding.
Okay, let's stick with that. You got into karma and biology and many things and compassion. Okay, well, in order to work on not finding the not finding, the first thing you have to do is try to find and fail. So it's not really a problem for anyone until you've really not found. When you look for the real, first of all, and the first step in that is to find in yourself the fact that you assume you are a really real self. Not just a real self. If you can assume you're a real self, you have one, you are one. But what we are assuming is that we, unless we're enlightened, is that we really real selves. You know, like an extra edge of the real. So then, first we have to acknowledge that we feel that, and we almost have to use the inference, because we all want to be goody-goody, and we all want to be like cool and realistic and enlightened and many things, and actually you can quickly glance inside yourself and feel, oh yeah, I'm just an anatomy and this and that, and actually the nihilism has like a good side to it, the materialist scientists, in that they dissect everything, and it's all nothing, they think. Mm-hmm. They think they find the nothing of it. They found that. They think so, because everything's dissected, you know? So we can hop on their thought experiment and their sort of reality teachings very easy and dissolve everything, right? But when we do that, aligning it together with admitting to ourselves that we don't really agree with that, because when we're upset, that upset is the realest thing in the world, and we'll trample anybody about it. Or when we're threatened our life, we'll kill all the ones. And you know, we feel justified in doing so, because ours is more real than their life is, you know. And so that's when we find that there's a really real self here that's more real than other things. When we find that, then we really look for that. We decide to be in case, because we sort of respect these enlightenment people, or we wouldn't, I mean, you do, or you wouldn't be here. We sort of think maybe they have something going, you know, that they, like Dalai Lama seems like a cheery camper in spite of the fact he's presiding over a nation that's suffering genocide from a vast, huge thing, and the world is turning its back on it because they want to make money out of the Chinese. And yet he's cheery on top of that, facing death. And his people who he deeply loves are dying and being killed. So therefore, he must have something going on to be able to still be cheery. He's either a total psycho or he's like has some different consciousness. And yet, by remaining as cheery, still try to do something about the deadly situation. And use the cheer, actually, needing the cheer to have the energy to do it, actually, in fact. Which is actually correct. And not really hating even the evildoers, but part of the being cheery. Never giving up on them. So that's the first thing. So first we find that there's something we think is really real, and we don't necessarily agree with all this stuff. We don't even agree with the nihilist scientists either, and we don't agree with the relativist scientists, is what I would call the Buddhist relativist scientists. And then we first do that. Then we look for that. Then, as I predict, and as they have predicted, and their psychological or phenomenological literature predicts, if we really do that with the yogic concentration, effort, and sustained effort, takes time, we will come to a place of not finding anything. And in a way, not finding the not finding ahead of time in an inferential or intellectual way is important in that, actually. Because there are some threshold moments when you go really deep there where fear arises, serious fear. Oh, I'm obliterating my mind. Am I artificially creating an Alzheimer's state where I won't know who I am or who anything, what anything is? Will I become a vegetable who doesn't even know like what my body is? I mean, this is good because this goes really, really deep. The sense of absolute me, and I'm confidence in all my network of concepts is so strong that when we drill through it and realize how arbitrary it is, there's a fear that we'll be completely disoriented forever, right? And we'll become like catatonic or something. There are all these kind of fear, or we'll become nothing. We'll annihilate ourselves. We'll die. Assuming death to be sort of a complete oblivion. There are threshold moments like that. And the way of going through them and overcoming that fear of recoiling from them is I could never become nothing because it's not a thing. and it's not a place. So whatever this is, you know, I can't be stuck in it. It's like you jump out of a plane and overcome the fear of the skydive, of being smashed and crushed on the ground or smothered by the speed of air going by and your lungs collapsing. You overcome that fear by knowing you have a parachute. That's where intellect helps a lot.
But what if it's your intellect that feels like you're going crazy?
What?
What if it is the intellect that's actually...
Well, that's why that's more difficult than overcoming the fear of skydiving.
Is that fear?
Intellect is very powerful. That's one of American people who do spiritual paths. One of their big problems is they've all been educated up to kazoo through up to the PhD and the doctors and the lawyers and everything. And yet they're still fucked up, excuse my language. And they're not really that happy. So then they assume that all that learning was useless on an existential level. They assume that. So therefore, they are very vulnerable to the sales pitch of meditation people who say the big thing is don't think anything and there you'll be fine. You don't have to learn anything. Just don't think. All that thinking you did was really a pain in the neck. And your intellect is unreliable and it can't help you. That's false, actually. It can't help you. You desperately need it. Just like you need it if you want to skydive or if you have to jump out of a plane, you know, you need to know that you have that a parachute works and which lever to pull. And that's conceptual knowledge. Except in the case of Bill Gates. You know the joke?
No.
Well, Bill Gates and the Dalai Lama and a hippie were in an airplane flying to Las Vegas together. Uh-huh. And they got in a terrible storm. And Bill Gates was flying because he's all-knowing and he's the smartest man in the world. He was also the pilot. And the pilot was flying. That's right. And Bill Gates and the hippie and the Dalai Lama. That's right. And so the pilot comes and says, I'm sorry, we have to abandon ship, but there's only 3 parachutes in this plane. And I've got one of them, goodbye, and jumps out. And then Bill Gates says, well, I'm sorry, but I'm the smartest man in the world. No, I forgot. I'm sorry how many people I'm getting wrong. Anyway, he says, I'm the smartest man in the world, so I've got to survive. I'm terribly sorry. So he grabs a parachute and he jumps out. And says, then the Dalai Lama says to the hippie, okay, there's one more parachute here. You take it. Go ahead. I'm the Dalai Lama. I'll be reincarnated. No problem. So the hippie said, no, that's all right, Your Holiness. We can both jump. There are 2 parachutes left. The smartest man in the world just grabbed my backpack and jumped out of the plane. I'm sorry. I apologize. I just thought we should lighten up since you're having a freak out there about your intellect. So, and that's mean to Bill Gates. I apologize, Bill Gates. I know you're wonderful. And you're listening to Melinda, so you're improving. So, saving the world right through the foundation.
The compassion.
So the point is, one thing about not finding, at least knowing that intellectually ahead of time, is very, very important. That's the royal reason of relativity, which you know, because that helps you when you get in threshold moments that are blocking you from really, you know, letting it all go. And really being reality somehow, you know, without trying to own it and seize it and grasp it and like merge with it, with knowing that there is no state of disappearance that itself is the intrinsic reality. That's not the self. That's very key to know that ahead of time.
Say that one more time.
The experience of disappearing into a vast space will not be the ultimate state. Nirvana is not a state apart from the world. There are states like that seem to be completely apart from everything. The Buddha taught them in terms of what are called the 4 non-material states. And they are, or media in a way. You know, state is okay, but it's not a realm. They're states, or media. And these are infinite space, infinite consciousness, absolute nothingness, a state of absolute nothingness, and a state beyond consciousness and unconsciousness. The 4 subtlemost states that the yogi can attain. Any of which, if we attained with our normal absolutizing habit patterns, concretizing everything we experience pattern, we would think we'd reach the end of the universe, and we'd reach the ultimate reality of the universe, just like the very, very untrained, un-yogic, and philosophically naive scientists, when they don't find anything on the atom, they think they've found nothing. When they have when they put an EEG on a corpse, this one guy in Bellevue who wants a Nobel Prize, big fMRI guy, he put a corpse in an fMRI machine and nothing was happening in the brain of the corpse. So he felt he'd found nothing in that brain. And they felt that the real mind, there is no real mind of the person, because when the brain is not functioning physiologically, there's nothing there. So therefore, that's a proof that you're nothing at death. Assuming that the nothing that you personally are stays with your body. And it fails to be detected by the fMRI. Therefore, the fMRI discovered a nothing that is your nothing, and therefore he's proved that you don't exist after death. It's showing he's insane. He doesn't know what he's saying. Okay? So that's good about the not finding of the not finding. That might help about the not finding. Now, the thing about compassion is, of course, is you are compassionate to your own fingertip without a problem. It's non-dual from your sensitivity. When you stick it on a hot pot, you remove it, and then you put cold water or hot water or ointment or whatever it is that you do. You know, about the owl. And you don't say, you don't expect the finger to say, oh, you're so kind, thank you so much. It's just natural. So you go to where your sense of boundary between self and other dissolves under analysis like everything else. And then you're in a field where the feeling of other is right there too. And it's not you anymore. So therefore, you're automatically compassionate for all other people. That's why the ultimate great compassion, universal compassion, is said to be the compassion that has no object. That is to say, it's not a subject apart from another object. Mm-hmm.
So when you say compassion for another person, it's not that for another person.
That's well, no. Ultimately, it isn't. But relatively, if you're someone who has that kind of expanded field, an enlightened being, then you can still manifest as a seemingly separate body and put on some bandage or whatever it takes that might help the person or give a teaching. The ultimate thing is, of course, enable the person to understand this quality of their, that even their pain is only illusory pain, even though it's still painful and they can illusorily heal it. But it's not double pain. You know, like when I have a pain, being unenlightened, it's a really real pain. And it's a pain that I have a pain. And I'm going to all tangle up more and more about the pain, and it gets worse and worse. Okay? So let's go. We can go on that one. And the whole thing about biology and the physics of this emptiness and the physics of seeing yourself, your own neurons, subatomic particle dissolve into the past the wave particle paradox and everything like this, and yourself viscerally and physically experiencing it, so it becomes a physical scientific discovery. The point of all of that, why I hammer on it so much, is that we have a misplaced confidence in what we're told is reality, not from religions, but from people who are supposedly the quote-unquote natural scientists. And therefore, although we meditate, and we go for diet, and we try to figure out nutrition, since they don't study nutrition, the so-called doctors, they have 2 hours in 9 years of study of nutrition. And we have to figure it out ourselves, and we do all this thing, get some herbal thing, we do that and do that. But finally, when they say, you have a tumor, it's growing there, or your blood is doing something. We'll now take out your marrow, we'll put some marrow in from some Maori in New Zealand, we have some fresh marrow that matches you, and oh, weird crap they do, and they make $1 million. That's where our confidence is. And we have no confidence in these other things, so we cannot heal ourselves. And we don't really have confidence. That's why my teacher, I told you the story. One of his interruptions of me, I was meditating away 3 a.m. in the chapel in New Jersey at this temple we built there together. And I was a monk, had my robe, shaved head. As my daughter said years later, I looked like Henry Miller in drag. And I was sitting there like... And he comes in, turns on the light. What are you doing? My old Mongolian guy. I says, what do you mean, what am I doing? I'm meditating. He says, why are you meditating? He says, at this hour, instead of resting. I said, what do you mean, why am I meditating? I'm a Buddhist monk. I want to attain enlightenment. He says, oh, you can't attain enlightenment. You're an American. I said, what do you mean? I'm a Buddhist monk, and I believe in former and future life. No, no, no. He says, you have some theories, yes, but you're an American, and when you get enlightened, it is your mind that gets enlightened. and you don't believe you have one. And then I argued for weeks with him after that, and argued and argued, but I finally realized what he meant. We don't really have confidence that we have a mind. We really don't. So we don't really think our mind is that powerful. And it's part of the whole culture. That's why we don't vote. That's why we have such a crappy government. And a bunch of absolute people who don't care about us at all. They only care about their donors. Because we think it's so disgusting we don't vote because we think our vote is meaningless. What we think is meaningless. We are meaningless. We're told that from youth as reality, that you're meaningless. The whole world is meaningless. It's a random accident. Nobody knows how it happened. It has no purpose. It doesn't go anywhere. That's a bunch of superstition, weird creationists. So as long as you think that, you will never ask more questions because you think that doesn't matter, the answers.
I do.
And because you ask questions, you think it matters. So I'm praising you. I'm complimenting.
I'm just a little lost. Why?
You're a little lost.
I am.
Not a little lost. You're very lost.
Maybe
you're
I'm
really, lost. Really lost. I'm just kidding. I'm sorry. What?
I don't understand why if one doesn't believe they have a mind, how that means that you can't be enlightened. Don't you want
to? Well, enlightenment is the mind. It's mind over matter. Enlightenment is an extraordinary state of awareness.
But isn't a mind a something it's not nothing? I mean, I don't understand that.
Yeah, but the scientist tells you it's nothing. Daniel Dennett has a book, Consciousness Explained. He's a tenured professor in philosophy at Tufts University. And he's a part of a whole network. They all tell you this. And that means that, yes, your brain makes you think you have a mind as long as nobody will lobotomize you. It makes you think so. But the minute the brain stops, boom, it's total unconsciousness. There's nothing that continues that's not the brain.
But you call that the mind?
No, they do.
That continues?
They call it the mind.
Oh, I see.
I call the mind this subtle soul continuum that actually creates the brain, actually. It brings its spiritual gene or mental gene or soul gene from previous lives of vast evolutionary experience that you, Lisa, have had. When you were a zebra, you came to the head of the zebra and said, I have a little question. My stripe, I don't like my stripe on my butt there. And why does my stripe have to go all the way around my butt? And there's no like nice part, it's just solid black. So how did that happen?
But your monk roommate, he said you... because
No, not roommate, my teacher.
No, he said you couldn't reach enlightenment because you didn't...
He was getting me to dig deeper.
Did he mean the soul continuum that you're talking about?
Yes, he did. But what he meant was he was getting me to dig deeper in my reality sense, which was not necessarily changed that easily by me saying, oh, yes, I think there's former and future life. Mm-hmm. It wasn't changed so easily. Mm-hmm. It had to go deeper to find that reality sense. And that's why, for example, in writing about sort of Buddhist medicine, which is what Menla is about, you know, Ayurveda, acupuncture, doing these different things, you know, one has to first question the misplaced confidence. In that, like, I have a friend who at mere youthful age of 76, who was healthy as a horse. He was tremendously macho and healthy on his second marriage, adored his children, small children, you know, etc. And, you know, knowingly, the wife married him when she was still of childbearing age. He was an elder, you know. But they were happy to do it. They were a happy couple, perfectly happy. And then suddenly he's told by these people, you have this very rare and dangerous leukemia. And he was trying to be hip with this yogic wife and all this, you know, Ayurveda, Matabi Joyce, the whole thing. But the minute they told him that, oh yes, take me and put me in the machine. And we all did divinations, we consulted shamans, we did many things. And he could have had a few more very good years if he'd gone, and he lived in California where they do lymphatic drainage, they do acupuncture. Steve Jobs lived 7 years with pancreatic cancer. And then only when in the last year and a half to those people and quickly died. But they tell you when you have pancreatic cancer, you're finished within 6 months.
3 months, right.
And he lived 7 years with that diagnosis and made more iPhones and made more billions and, like, annoyed more employees, by doing non-conventional things. But then he finally collapsed to the conventional and they killed him. And of course, then they wrote books about him. Oh, he should have gone to the conventional thing right away. He was so stupid. He would have. But the conventional thing gives you no time with pancreatic cancer. That was an irrational thing they wrote because they're part of the machine themselves, the biographer. I won't mention the name. But their sponsors are the people who own the machine. So this guy died like a mummified, weird Egyptian person, like this for months of whatever life they let him have. They matched all these marrows and they poisoned and they did all this crap to him. And he, you know, against everyone else, all his friends, everyone, please don't do that. But that's where his faith was. Mm-hmm. That's where his placebo effect. That's where his belief system was. And it was very sad, I think, personally. He was a good friend.
I'm sorry.
It means that, so that's why I thought that karma biology business is a big deal. I told you that now Thomas Nagel, a professional philosopher, has a good book, Mind and Cosmos, where he reasons in a very calm manner and very modern philosophy acceptable manner, analytic manner, that the attempt to explain reality about through materialistic reductionism as if the world of sheer objectivity still exists by people in denial that they have a subjectivity that's part of the measurement that they consider to be what was solving everything, is doomed to fail. It's completely non-coherent. And there must be, and they assume they have to stick to it no matter what, because the only alternative is a fundamentalist theism, you know, sort of like some simplistic soul theory. And there must be a mind theory that is scientifically, there must be a way of dealing with introspection and subjectivity scientifically, that can then be a scientific biology that involves the mind. Bye-bye, involves the mind. And he's calling for the karma theory, basically. That's already anticipated by thousands of years. That's what the karma theory is. Your mind is one of the three genetic factors. It's at the gene level. The mind has a gene level. Just like your nostril, that you just, your nose, it has a pattern, has a gene instruction, so your child's nose will resemble it, and it resembles your parents. So there's a subtle place where the nose potential is hanging out. So therefore, what's in the subtle level of your mind, your basic mental openness or closedness, mm-hmm. or rigidity, your paranoidness or your lovingness, mm-hmm. is encoded. Mm-hmm. And that will determine then what kind of genes of which kind of species and animal you will gravitate toward in a subtle dreamlike plane, in a matrix-like dreamlike plane when you go through the rabbit hole, the ultimate rabbit hole that everybody goes through, not just Neo in the Matrix taking the red pill instead of the blue pill. We all take the red pill when we die, which we all will do. And then you go out of control. So, but what your fundamental state at the deepest level of encoded openness and receptivity and resilience versus rigid imposition of paranoid sort of, I'm just want to be like this and I'm holding on to that, will determine what you'll gravitate toward. It's very imaginable as a mechanism. You know, the mechanism of it is very imaginable. And that's where science should go. And like I was telling my friend who went left early, our dear friend Scott, the scientists should be trained to cope with this. They should have meditative training, yogic training, as part of their physics PhD. Then they would be a different kind of chemist or physicist or computer scientist or neuroscientist. They would be more effective. They would go deeper in understanding the mind and brain when they could look at the mind and brain internally with their own mind, with their more subtle mind. They could look inside themselves. They could give a break to the monkeys that they're slaughtering madly. No, they could give them a break. They might do in a couple of monkeys to test out a little toxic something, but they would, the level that they do uselessly slaughtering them by the hordes is terrible.
Yeah.
really bad example to life, you know, and to their own karma. You know. Emily, do you have a question? You look happy. You must have done good yoga in the morning. Oh, I have to announce, we're not doing that puja. It's been vetoed from higher authority. So tomorrow we will meditate together. Because of for some reasons. The staff is overstressed, whatever it is. Okay. It's my fault. I shouldn't ascribe guilt to higher authority. It's my own fault. Okay. How are you doing? You fine? You fine? Did you, that means you have a dozen more questions written in that notebook?
I hope so.
I'm glad. We'll get to them. Oh, you have one. Oh, good. See, you're stimulating critical. This is very important.
No, it's interesting because, you know, we're here at Buddha and the Yogi, right? So
we what?
Buddha and the Yogi.
Yes, exactly.
So, you know, I practice Ashtanga and I teach. And
yes.
The problem with a lot of people even getting on the mat is their mind.
Yeah, of course.
And it's very interesting because they have to, and the whole practice is about training ourselves not to listen to the negativity in the mind.
Yes.
And the things that don't give them the confidence to get up and do it again.
Yes.
So it's really, and it's just like, you know, kind of just coming together for me, even as a teacher.
Good.
I say that.
Oh, good.
And I practice that, but it's like, and I have a young student, and she's young, she's like 23, and she says, oh, I said, the mind is very powerful. Mm-hmm. Do not...
Yeah.
You know, just do not diss the mind.
Yes, and you know the old Freudian thing about
that. It's going to tell you want to sleep. It's going to tell you not to get up. It's going to tell you to stay in bed.
Yes.
It's cozy and warm, but you have a better day when you practice.
Yes.
So it's this interesting thing. It's just
that's right.
For people
well, you know, that's the Freudian
the
Freudian thing of the superego, which is the internalized parent, you know, or parents, you know. Who have told people, you know, when people are little kids, they say, don't do that, you can't do that. Some parent who's a little less conscious will sort of harshly say that about a lot of things, but really with a good intention, you know, you can't put your finger in the electric socket or something, you know. Then you can't gets imprinted in the people's mind, they know, I can't do this and I can't do that. And their voice, they think it's their own voice, but it's the internalized parental authority voice. And that's so you have to deal with the Raja Yoga, you know, and that's why we're going back to this evening. We'll look back again at the Vibhuti thing. And the Raja Yoga thing is not just to be ignored. The Raja Yoga thing is where those last three branches of the Ashtanga are dealt with, which is the mind. You know? But on the other hand, I'm not a purist in the sense personally that we shouldn't, that someone who comes just to improve their posture, just to improve their health, just sort of, I don't know, to chase girls or whatever. I mean, even that, okay, it's a little healthier, a little more taking responsibility about their body. We shouldn't, like, kick them out because they're not doing all piety and so forth. Do you know what I mean? I'm sure you don't either, so that's good.
Well, it eventually comes that way. It eventually,
yeah, they'll,
maybe years, maybe 5 years.
Yes, yes.
Eventually something's going to...
So taking a little bit of the thread, they pull on it, and then the whole thing will start to manifest. Yes, exactly.
This particular individual is very special, and it's pretty much like saved her life from going down another path.
Oh, great.
Of alcohol.
I think it saved a lot of people's life. How many people do yoga in this country now? A few million? Mm-hmm. How many?
I don't know.
5 million? 10?
Well, yeah, because this country is a country of addiction and compulsiveness, and yoga replaces that.
Yes,
so
it does, and helps
way.
Free oneself from that.
Yes.
Absolutely.